Good morning, members. This morning we are going to have two folks, or now three, which is wonderful, visit with us from the University of Minnesota and to help us with our decision-making process as we do our budget for this year. Because what you'll see as we go through why, as we look at problems and think how they're going to impact in 2 years or in 5 years, is that the right time horizon? And so that's. But I'm going to let our guest this morning explain, and I also just welcoming Representative Bill Hilty, who chairs our Energy Policy and Finance Committee, because these subjects interrelate so much. So with that, welcome to our guests, and I believe they're going to do a presentation, take clarifying questions as we go, but save more of the discussion for the end. So if we could welcome, and if you would give your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Ann Kapuscinski. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the University of Minnesota, from the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology, and I'm co-director of the Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Initiative at the university.
And my name is Laura Schmidt-Olabisi. I'm currently an assistant professor at Michigan State University in the Community, Agriculture, Recreation, and Resource Studies Department, and also the Environmental Science and Policy Program.
And I'm Peter Rice. I'm a Regents Professor in the Department of Forest Resources at the U, and also co-director of the Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Initiative.
And I should add that Laura was first hired by us 2 years ago, and we brought her to Minnesota because of her systems modeling skills, and she became a really key member of our research team. So she just recently left from Michigan State, but we plan to keep her engaged in this kind of work. So we're pleased to talk to you today about a project that we've been involved with, funded primarily by a grant from the Archibald Bruce Foundation at the University of Minnesota. And this project has really focused on an innovative way of doing very long future analysis in order to increase Minnesota's adaptability to uncertain futures. And it's been a collaboration among a number of groups, but the key collaborators are our Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Initiative that was funded by the Bush Foundation, and a pre-existing organization distributed around the state called the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership, which, if I remember correctly, was initially funded by the legislature and is administered through the University of Minnesota Extension Service. And one of our co-authors, Catherine Drager, is the director of the Regional Partnership. I thought she might be here, but I don't see her at the moment. And this project has led us to three major realizations, which I'm going to start with because they're really fundamental realizations that underpin the presentation that you're going to see. We're going to present to you some scenarios that were actually developed with intensive participation with citizens around the state and then some modeling. But the realizations are important to get out at the beginning. And the first one might be sort of self-evident that the world is complex. But the specific point here is that there are very complex interactions among elements in environmental systems, sort of modeled by the, represented by the circle for the ecosystem on the right, and elements in the from the human systems or the social systems. And often these interactions are very hard to understand and very hard to control. And there can sometimes be an interaction between two parts of the system when you're trying very hard to optimize one element that will then lead to ripple effects through the overall social environmental system. And one simple example, which Laura will actually say more about in a minute, is water use in the future if some of the predictions from climate change models turn out to be true. Many of these models are suggesting that some parts of Minnesota, such as our southwestern region and some of our other agricultural regions, will experience higher periods of drought, which would be a change in the ecosystem. Well, one human reaction to that during higher periods of drought is that farmers will need to withdraw more groundwater in order to continue growing things. And so if Minnesota in the future has made a very major investment in biomass crop production, that on the one hand will be good for the environment in that it would help us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. It would be good economically because it would help provide energy independence. But it could potentially make us more vulnerable environmentally because water withdrawal from groundwater would be greater, which makes the water use more vulnerable and less sustainable over time. So trying to identify and examine some of these complex relationships and thinking those through now, but trying to identify what some of those relationships, how they might unfold in the future, can help to clarify the impact of the choices that we make today. A second really important realization, and this one is especially hard for we Americans who've got this can-do attitude of we can change the world, and of course we have changed the world in many ways, but it is that the future is not what you think it's going to be. For example, if you were living in 1909 Minnesota and were used to the main modes of transportation, such as the streetcar picture on the left, would you have predicted the kind of transportation that we have in 2009 Minnesota and all both the benefits but also the challenges and problems that it has caused for us? So the point here is that you can't fully create the future. We will inhabit a future that is shaped partly by our deliberate actions, including actions that was made by legislative bodies, but also by unexpected surprises. And often the difficulty with unexpected surprises is that they could be events either in the social sphere or in the environmental sphere that happen beyond Minnesota and might be an aspect of our environment or society that none of us are even thinking of right now, not even focusing on. So it becomes important to try to investigate multiple futures. Try to think through how might the future unfold in a number of different ways that we could not fully control so that today we can better prepare for the full range of possibilities. And that's one of the main things we really tried to dig into in this project we're going to talk to you about today. And then the third fundamental realization has to do with adaptability, increasing our ability to cope with change and uncertainty since we cannot fully predict and control the future. This is about, first of all, the idea that some natural resources and some of our uses of natural resources are absolutely essential, such as maintaining adequate quantity of water across the different parts of the state, not just in one part of the state, and adequate water quality. And to sustain these essentials, if we can't fully control how the future might unfold, requires building in a certain amount of adaptability so that we can cope with changes. We need to build the capacity to work with change as opposed to being a victim of it. And on this slide, I have two pictures to try to give you some example of what I'm talking about, coping with change rather than being a victim of it. Change can happen at a very local level. So this picture on the left is showing you a very local view of a landscape where there's a highly turbid shallow lake on the left side and a clear lake next to it. We now know from very scientific work that's been done a little bit of what causes these state changes. So one of the real challenges here, one of the reasons why this is a good example of being a victim of change, is clear lakes can very quickly slip into this turbid lake state. And once they slip into that state, it's very, very difficult, if not potentially impossible, to reverse them back to the clear water state. And this is really the outcome of the legacy of the intersection of many changes that have happened, changes in land use over time that have led, for example, to people using more fertilizer, having fertilizer runoff, but also changes in the species composition by us deciding as a society for cultural reasons or economic reasons to import exotic species. So we now know from scientific work that invasive carp can actually exacerbate this and can be one of the triggers that leads to the turbid lake state. And then on the right side, I just put this picture that you've probably seen before that tries to very quickly encapsulate the idea that climate change models are predicting that there's going to be big changes in precipitation and average temperatures in Minnesota, both in the winter and in the summer. And that's just to quickly get across the idea that change can also happen on a much larger national and regional level. And so the challenge is to build capacity to work with that change so that we don't become a victim of a lot of the negative impacts of climate change, but instead position ourselves to minimize negative impacts and to maintain the things that we really care about, especially our essential natural resources. So the objectives of the project, which we formally called Minnesota 2050, Pathways to a Sustainable Future, are threefold. The first one has been to build capacity in systemic thinking, thinking in the systems level about the human system and the environmental system and how they interact, and strategic agility through the exploration of scenarios. Some of you might know that Salt Oil Company was probably one of the first leaders in the business community to develop the use of scenarios to anticipate how society and how the world might change and affect their business over a very long term. They really legitimated the use of scenarios for this kind of strategic and agile planning. But now it's being used all over the world by business leaders, by researchers, and increasingly by people in government. And I think in the environmental sciences, it's relatively new, but it's become, especially recently, been recognized as a very powerful tool. And so we have, our project, as you'll see in a moment, centers very heavily on scenario exploration. And we then, second objective is to use insights from citizen leaders who we actually work with to develop the scenarios, as you'll see in a moment, to use their insights to focus research and quantitative analysis of environmental trends that's done by us, the scientists, researchers at the university, but it could also be done by other people. And interestingly, our project has actually spun off, in addition to our scenario work and the modeling that we're going to show you today, it has inspired and spun off a number of other parallel projects. For example, in one of them, we did a much more in-depth analysis of options for reducing greenhouse gas emissions to the year 2050 in order to meet the 80% goal. And we have an article that's just come out, scientific article that's come out on that. We're not going to talk about that today, but if people are interested, we can give you access to the article. And another very interesting example is our co-director, my colleague Peter Wright here, has just gotten a grant to the University's Institute on the Environment to look at basically ways to bolster both economic and environmental resiliency in the northern forest region of northeastern Minnesota using some of this kind of scenario approach and also an awful lot of participatory involvement with groups like the Nature Conservancy and the Forest Stewardship Council, you're saying. So just to give you a sense that this approach is actually leading to a lot of spin-offs. And then the third objective is to identify policies and practices that will foster adaptability to multiple futures. So now I'm just going to very quickly give you a very brief feel for how we produce the scenarios, and then when I'm done with this part, Laura is going to actually walk you through a summary description of five statewide scenarios that evolved through this very bottom-up process, and then show you also some modeling output from a model that we developed to complement the scenarios. The first phase of this work involved generating scenarios using a process whose acronym is INSPECT. This is a process that was developed by people in Australia, and it's been used in many different settings. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones is it was used at a national level in Australia to try to develop scenarios for the future of the entire teaching profession in Australia. So we started by bringing together citizen leaders who were picked by the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. They came together in workshops in seven regions of the state, and we started them off by asking them a focal question. How are we interacting with the landscape and natural resources in 2050, and how is the environment affecting their quality of life? So we put them through a process that sort of forced them to imagine that they're living in 2050, perhaps with their child or their grandchild. And then they were given a set of prompting questions to begin to describe what's actually happening in the natural environment in 2050, what's happening socially, what's happening politically, economically, culturally, and in technology, and especially what's happening in those different elements that could affect the way they would answer this question about how are we interacting with the landscape and natural resources, and how is the environment affecting our quality of life. Then we ran them through a very interactive process with a facilitator to rearrange these individual elements they produce, these individual descriptions, into multiple coherent scenarios. We talked about the scenarios at the workshop, and then after the workshop, our research team came back with that information. We consolidated what would have been something like 10 to 12 scenarios that came out of each regional workshop, consolidated them into a fewer number of about 4 or 5 scenarios by drawing together common themes. And then Laura went to work developing a model to model some of the trends about issues that kept coming up in the scenarios. So they're informed by the scenarios, but using actual data that we have about what's happened presently to try to model trends of what might happen in the future. And the kinds of things that came up then at these first workshops was a multiplicity of different scenarios. These titles on the left give you just a very quick feel. Some of them were very dystopic, like dark collapse. Others were very very utopic, the promise of post-carbon technologies, and then there was grave, a lot of things in between. And on the right side, just put a few bullets of one of the scenarios, an interesting one that came out of the Northwest regional workshop called Saudi Arabia Biomass. I won't dwell on the details of that right now, but we put those bullets there just to remind you that these scenarios, in all cases, the citizens develop descriptions of what's happening economically, what's happening technologically, some of the things happening in the environment, and some of the social and political forces that are shaping that scenario. Then in phase two, we ran a second set of workshops going back, this time I think it was with just 6 of the regions, to explore the scenarios in order to hone strategic thinking. And we started this by having these citizen leaders who spanned everything from being farmers, like corn soybean farmers, grass seed farmers, community bankers, religious leaders, some government agency people, teachers, small business owners, editors, county commissioners, etc. We asked them to first sit down and through a reflective process explore what are the current strategic actions that they're taking today to try to promote sustainable development. Then we ran them through a very interesting process that forced them to inhabit these scenarios. We actually made them imagine that they're living in 2050. We handed them 1 or 2 of the scenarios, again asked them a set of prompting questions that they had to really experience what it's like living in that scenario. So for example, we asked them, if you're living in this scenario, what are you doing to maintain adequate and clean water? What are you doing to maintain renewable energy? What are you doing, or what do you think other people in your community are doing in that scenario? And then we had people discuss insights in those scenarios. Then, after they had that experience, it was a very short experience, but it's almost like a improvisational theater experience of what's it actually like living in that future. Then Laura would stand up and present the trends in the quantitative modeling, and you're going to see some of that in a minute. And we had people explore those trends. When they saw that data, after they had the experience of living in the future, what would tend to happen is people would have these aha moments where light bulbs would turn on, and they'd realize that some of the things they thought should come together in a scenario are actually contradictory, or that if you get one thing happening, then it has a downside, like something that benefits the environment or that's really hurting society, or the other way around. And then finally, we have them go through a backcasting exercise where we said, okay, now that you have a taste of what all these possible futures could be like, what actions do you think would be most important to do today to manage our natural resources and our environment? And the most recent thing we did for that phase two is in November 2008, we had a statewide workshop where we brought together 44 people from around the state. It was a mix of legislators from the Senate and the House, citizen leaders, again, picked by the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership, a few agency people, some of the both private and public sector people who were involved in writing the LCCMR statewide conservation and preservation plan, et cetera. And we presented to them the scenarios that Laura's going to talk to you about today. And at the end of that workshop, in backcasting, we said to them, okay, now that you've inhabited these several possible scenarios for the whole state of Minnesota, please examine the recommendations from the LCCMR Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan and address this question. If you are living in this scenario in 2050, what do you wish that back in 2010 people had done for our natural resources? And the answer that these people gave is not the be-all and end-all. There were time constraints. We had to tell them only pick what you think should be your top 3. But the idea was to get them to get a feel for how going through the scenario process, and then that happens puts you gives you a different way of looking at the suite of options that you have for decisions today. So this particular group of people wish that people in 2010 had done at least the following: that they had at least supported local and regional conservation-based community planning, that they had at least kept water on the landscape, and that they had at least protected priority land habitat. So this gives you a feel for sort of the essentials that people realized after living in these futures they wish people had done in 2010. Now I understand that your committee has heard a lot of presentations about the statewide conservation plan, so if you wanted to look more carefully at what you hear about the rest of the presentation today, how it relates to the plan, I understand you have a document to let you do that. I'd like to turn the stage over now to Laura, who's going to then walk you through the scenarios and the modeling.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So I am going to talk to you about five scenarios that emerged from this process around the state. And these were five scenarios out of literally dozens that were generated. We chose these to emphasize some of the common themes that we saw emerging from these scenarios that were generated by people in these communities that really know their communities, know Minnesota very well. These are the names of the scenarios, and as we go through them, you'll notice some common themes. One of them is reduction in fossil fuel use in the future. Several of these scenarios have that in common. Another is the potential of a future in which Minnesota has limited economic trade with the nation or the world compared to today. That was a common theme in several futures. And in a couple of the futures, there was a theme of a great socioeconomic disparity, a gap between the wealthy and the poor in Minnesota. The way I'm going to present these scenarios to you today is using a model that we developed to look at interactions among energy, land, water, and population, particularly in each of the scenarios. So why would we present the scenarios to you this way instead of, say, just giving you the narratives that were developed? Well, there are several reasons. Many of you have probably worked with models before. I imagine that many of you have used a model in a kind of decision support context in which, say, you want to see the impact or the outcome of a decision, and so you run a model to see what a trend might be without the decision and then with the decision implemented. This is a different kind of model. This is not to support a particular decision, but rather to illustrate some of the interconnections among, as I mentioned, energy, land, and water in these different scenarios. So the way you might want to think of it is, if we were giving a PowerPoint presentation in the year 2050 in any one of these scenarios, this is what we might see in terms of this is how much energy we're using, this is how much water we're using, and for what, et cetera. So that's maybe the way you should think about it. And we believe that this approach helps us to explore relations in a complex system and share those with the people that generated the scenarios. It was also a way to compare the scenarios with one another in a kind of semi-quantitative way, and also compare them with the current situation, and then to examine the scenario consistency with the information that we have. So these scenarios were generated by people that are very knowledgeable about their communities and about Minnesota, but at the same time, they may not have had all of the data and information about certain constraints on the system that they were imagining. So this is a way to combine the imagination of the scenarios with some of the concrete knowledge that we have about Minnesota systems today. As with any model, there are many assumptions embedded in it, and I would emphasize that as we go through these, that you not focus on a particular number, but really focus on the relations between the variables that we're looking at and what they reveal about the system that we have here in Minnesota. So one of the assumptions is that resource efficiencies are at current levels. So if, for example, it takes a certain amount of water and a certain amount of energy to produce a dollar of industrial output today, it's the same in the future. The exception to that is if the scenario developed by people around the state explicitly says we are using water more efficiently, we are using energy more efficiently. In that case, we included a higher efficiency. Food and energy production per unit of land in the model are at current levels, again, unless that was explicitly specified in the scenario that has changed. I wanted to explore a little bit of a climate change dynamic in these future scenarios. And so the way I did that was to kind of introduce a drought situation in each given given scenario. And climatologists are saying that in the future, with climate change, we may experience more periods of drought in Minnesota, in addition to more periods of extreme rainfall events. And so the drought situation is the minimum historical rainfall that we've ever experienced, or minimum historical precipitation, I should say, that we've ever experienced in Minnesota, which I believe is about 10 inches in a year, so very, very low. In a drought, as you'll see, more water needs to be used for growing things because plants, vegetation need a certain minimum amount of water to be productive. And as I mentioned, the model is really a snapshot. It's an illustration, and it's not intended to support a given decision. But hopefully it will reveal some of the complexities and feedbacks that are in the system of Minnesota. So I'm going to start with the first scenario here, and you have some of the bullet points on your handouts, called regional self-reliance. So the kind of feel of this scenario is almost like Minnesota before the Industrial Revolution, but with a few changes. So the idea is that Minnesota is very self-reliant, as the title suggests. All food and energy is being produced within the state. There's limited trade with other states or with other countries. There's reduced consumption. And it's interesting that in this scenario, there's actually a higher use of energy than in the current energy mix. There are a couple reasons for that. One is that the population has grown according to the scenario. Another is that the type of fuels that are being used to generate electricity in this scenario, which are the scenario mentioned wood, for example, is less efficient when converted to electricity than fossil fuels are. So you need a larger amount of wood to turn into electricity compared with coal, for example, at least under our current way that we produce these things. Because Minnesota is growing all of its own food and fuel in this scenario, there's less land that is in natural uses. I could say that the land cover in 2005, I just classified it roughly. The natural land includes forested land, which of course is also being used for productive purposes. But actually, Minnesota would not be able to produce all of its own transportation fuels and food under the stipulations given in the scenario. So I had to introduce some kind of fuel efficiencies to accomplish that. So if Minnesota's driving fleet, if fuel efficiency was increased to 55 miles per gallon, then Minnesota would be able to produce all its own fuel and food. Water use, similar in quantity in the scenario, but more of it is being used for producing renewable electricity. Yeah, and I apologize for the handouts that it's hard to see the black and white reproductions, but we have another copy that has a better reproductions of the graph, so we'll be able to get that to you after the presentation. So this is what I mentioned before, that I modeled the drought situation in any of the different scenarios. And in this scenario, under a drought situation, more water would be used. And the reason for that, as Anne mentioned and I mentioned before, is that when you're growing a lot of things on the landscape to produce your food and fuel, you need to pump more water to produce in a drought situation. And we do see that historically in Minnesota when there's less rainfall, irrigation rates go up. So if we're producing more fuel on the landscape and we need a certain amount of fuel to for a society to function, then we're going to need to pump more water in a drought situation to accomplish that. And this amount of water that would be pumped in a drought situation would exceed actually the rough amount available for precipitation for human needs. That means that we would be drawing down the groundwater. So I created a kind of summary slide for each scenario comparing these different variables in the future scenario to the current 2005 value. And so the metric here is percentage change from a 2005 value. So if the bar is above the line, that means that there's a positive change in 2050. And if it's below the line, that means that there's a negative change. So for example, in the regional self-reliance scenario, population has grown by about 30%. fossil fuel use has declined by 100% because in this scenario there is no fossil fuel use. And water and land use for energy production are both increased. And so as we presented these scenarios or had people inhabit these scenarios at the regional workshop, these are the questions that we would ask them. If you imagine yourself living in the scenario in 2050, what would you do, what would you advocate for concerning conservation of water, conservation of fish and wildlife, ecosystems, and other key natural resources? So I encourage you to kind of jot down some notes and think about that as we go through these scenarios, and then afterwards we can discuss some of this. So here's the second scenario generated from this process called corporate industrialism. So I think of this scenario as almost like modern-day China, in that there's a greatly reduced natural resource use, but because it's regulated so heavily by the state. Resource use per person, I should say. And there's very tight control, very tight monitoring of people's consumption of energy and other natural resources. So in this scenario, you see a decrease in total energy use, but we're still using fossil fuels. And one of the consequences of this kind of decrease in natural resource impacts is that there is more natural land in the state. Water use is up in this scenario for industrial purposes because this is still an industrial scenario in which the industry is kind of controlled by a select group of people. And because of the kind of fossil fuel reliance in this future scenario, the scenario is less susceptible to drought. In other words, So fossil fuel production of energy does not require more or less water in a drought situation. It's the same all around. So you don't have increased drawdowns when you have a drought the way that you do with vegetation, where you need more water if you have less precipitation. So it's, in a sense, less drought sensitive. But still, in a drought situation, you would be withdrawing more than what scientists tend to say is the amount available for human consumption. So you'd be drawing down your groundwater. Again, this is a summary slide comparing this scenario to 2005 levels of these different resources. There is more land used for fuel production because this scenario does specify some biofuel production. There's more natural land and less land used for agriculture and less water used for agriculture. Again, this is the kind of summary question that we ask people. You know, imagine you or your child or grandchild are living in this scenario in 2050. What actions would you want to take to increase the preservation of natural resources in this scenario? The next scenario is what some people might see as almost a goal or a good endpoint for Minnesota. This is a scenario in which Minnesota has completely transitioned to a very green industrial economy. Its economy is going like gangbusters. It's producing a ton of electricity and energy for the national market, for the global market. Everything is very high tech. Everything is very energy efficient. And these are the technologies that people envisioned energy being produced. People are moving into Minnesota to work here. So energy production is huge, you know. It's enough to export 2.9 times the current U.S. electricity production, 1.5 times the current U.S. diesel consumption, with the caveat that this means every inch of land in Minnesota is devoted to energy production. There is nothing left for other purposes. And as this graph suggests, all of Minnesota's land is basically devoted to electricity production and transportation fuel production, and there's a very small sliver left for natural land use. In this scenario, the average water use is not so far changed from today because although there's a lot more production, there's also a lot more efficiency. This is one of the scenarios in which I did include increased water efficiency of production. But biofuel crop production and processing is one of the water uses that has grown the most in this future scenario. I would point out, too, that this scenario is very drought-sensitive. So, again, if you look at the right-hand column, the amount of water that would be withdrawn in a drought situation in this future scenario would be very high and far above the amount that would be available for human consumption in a renewable sense. So to summarize the scenario, lots of electricity consumption, lots of energy production, lots of water and land use for that. But fossil fuel use has dropped to zero because we're all using renewable fuels, and that's great, but there's a very high impact on the land and water resources of Minnesota. Again, the summary question, imagine if you're living in this scenario, what would you do? What actions would you advocate for? This urbanized biotechia is a scenario that I in my mind think of as a Blade Runner scenario, if any of you are familiar with that movie. It's a very kind of urban scenario, in some ways dystopic, but in some ways there are reduced impacts on natural resources in this scenario. There's a large gap between the wealthy and the poor. There are catastrophic weather events. And this is also a scenario in which there's limited trade with the rest of the world and the rest of the country. The idea is that the trade is only regional. So we're still in this scenario using coal, for example, from the Dakotas, but maybe not gasoline for transportation. And because of the large kind of poor or lower middle class population in this scenario, energy use is reduced. A lot of ethanol is being used and a lot of coal. Again, because of the lower natural resource consumption, when you see that, you also see more natural land available in the state. Less is being used for producing agriculture for export, for example, because there's less trade. More water is used primarily for industrial uses, so similar to the corporate industrialism scenario, that's part of the state economy that has grown. And like the corporate industrialism scenario, this scenario is not extremely drought sensitive. It is somewhat, but because you're not growing all of your own fuels within the state from biomass, you don't need a whole lot more water in a drought situation. Yet it is above the amount that would be available for human consumption in a drought, so you're still drawing down groundwater in a drought situation. And to summarize the scenario, you have increased population, you have increased electricity consumption per person. You do have more land used for fuel production because in this scenario you have to rely on ethanol from Minnesota to produce your transportation fuels. But fossil fuels consumed for vehicles are down. And again, imagine if you're living in this scenario, what would you do? A very urban Minnesota. How would you advocate for conservation of water, conservation of fish and wildlife, conservation of ecosystems? Okay, this is the final scenario, and I want to preface this by saying that when this first started emerging from the regional workshops, and it was a very common theme, this theme of kind of pandemic collapse, that at least one of these emerged from each region, I would say. My first reaction was, well, you know, that's never going to happen. That's completely unrealistic. However, if you look at the historical record of things that have happened in the U.S., and, you know, influenza pandemics, this is not extremely far-fetched. And last November, I was actually talking to a woman who works at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and I was describing these scenarios that had emerged from the state and said, you know, could there be some kind of pandemic? And she said, oh, yeah, that's actually very, very possible. So I'm just encouraging you to you know, if this at first seems like it's very unrealistic, it's a possibility that it might be good to at least consider if this should happen, what would we do? So in this scenario, there is a global pandemic. There's a breakdown of infrastructure because people that are manning the infrastructure are either dead or sick or fleeing to the rural areas. One of the consequences of this is that there's an almost total reduction in impacts on the environment, greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, resource extraction, et cetera. Large refugee population. And so in this scenario, you would see an almost total reduction in energy use. There would be a small amount of energy used for just basic human needs like heating and cooking, mostly for wood. Most of the land would grow back into a natural state as it would be abandoned. And I didn't bother modeling water extraction for this scenario because it seems that, you know, that the use of groundwater would be very minimal because people would be primarily using precipitation and surface water resources. So in this scenario, you've seen almost across-the-board reduction in some of these key variables, vehicle miles traveled, electricity consumption, fossil fuel use, et cetera. Oh, sorry. And then, again, the concluding question, if you were in this scenario and this pandemic collapsed, this very dystopic future, what might you do to advocate for conserving conservation of water, conservation of fish and wildlife, conservation of ecosystems? So I hope that this has served to stretch your thinking at least a little bit about the different kinds of futures that we may find ourselves inhabiting. And these are not, we're not saying that any of these will occur, but there are a range of things that it's good to keep in mind when we consider the unpredictability of the future and the need to adapt to a variety of different futures. So I'm just going to emphasize here some common themes that we saw emerging across these scenarios that were generated around the state. That might be worth looking at. One is that in every scenario except the pandemic collapse, which is an extreme, obviously, example, we saw population growth occur. That's not surprising. Population in Minnesota is expected to grow. The thing that I found interesting was that in every single one of these scenarios, this is a common theme around the state, in 2050, the vision is that fossil fuel use has decreased. And I think that is because people envision that these things are going to be replaced by other resources by the year 2050. And so that has consequences, obviously, for our greenhouse gas emissions, our energy independence, but also for land and water. And that's what I've tried to kind of show you in these different modeling scenarios. So a corollary to that is that in just about all of these scenarios, except pandemic collapse, land used for fuel production in Minnesota has increased, and increased dramatically. So if we're using less or fewer fossil fuels, we may need to be using more land to produce fuels that we need for transportation and electricity. And that was definitely present in the thinking of people around the state as they made these scenarios. And so I'm just going to bring up the question again that Anne posed towards the beginning of the presentation. This is what we asked people at the statewide scenario planning workshops. So for all the scenarios, if you consider across all five of them, if you look back in time to 2010, what actions do you wish people had taken so that your natural resource conservation work in 2050 could be more successful? And we want to point out this is not about altering these futures. It's about enhancing adaptability within a given future. So again, considering that there are aspects of the future that we cannot control, that we cannot predict, are the things that we can still do that will make us adaptable and flexible in any given future. Again, we mentioned the statewide workshop at the beginning of the presentation, or Anne did, and we posed this question at the statewide workshop, and the answers that people came up with that were in the particular context of that workshop and the constraints that we gave them of taking three things from the statewide conservation and preservation plan were the three that Anne mentioned before. So protecting priority land habitats, keeping water on the landscape, and supporting local and regional conservation planning.
And I'll just finish up by thanking our partners. I already mentioned at the beginning overwhelming majority of the funding for this project came from the Archibald Bush Foundation with a grant from the University of Minnesota. Our key partner was the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. They really drove the selection of diversity of citizen leaders in the different regions who were involved in developing the workshop developing scenarios. We also had some funding from the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment, particularly for the last workshop, statewide one. And all of us involved in this project actually also participated in the development of the LCCMR statewide conservation and preservation plan, and we did that sort of under the umbrella of the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment. And then finally, we collaborated with the LCCMR in convening the statewide workshop and inviting LCCMR members to attend, and they also helped identify other legislators to invite who did attend. So I think with that, we can take some questions.
Questions or either that or observations from members? I mean, the obviously water is one of the total common themes. As you were developing this, I saw that you were taking water from groundwater. Minnesota does not have a system of reusing water. just don't. Some states are starting to do that. Even North Dakota is. Have you looked at that particular theme at all, or would you suggest we look at that, or what do you pull out of your research that tells us about what we should be doing about water?
Madam Chair, that's actually a very complex and interesting question. Certainly, groundwater consumption emerged as one of the major themes around the state that people were thinking about into the future. The water charts that I showed you here were purely groundwater consumption, so I did not include surface water consumption that would be recycled or renewed in this model. In some of the future scenarios, there was a great deal of water recycling. For example, the Green Industrial Minnesota, that was one of the things specified in the scenario, that people were recycling water for fuel use. So I included that when I generated the figures. But the industrial production in that scenario is so huge that even with water recycling, water consumption is still significant. I don't necessarily have an answer as to what should be done, but I would definitely encourage all of you to think about water for all of the uses that we have in the state, and not only household consumption, but also energy production and et cetera, and how that might change in the future in different scenarios, and what actions we might advocate for concerning it now.
And I guess I would just add that, if I recall correctly, there have been at least two projects recently funded by the LCTMR to actually look at both water supply across the state, and Laura and another collaborator of ours, again inspired by this project, Professor Tang Wan So, are leading a current project that's looking at water usage, right,
mm-hmm.
Around the state. So I think a first step, at least, is to just improve as much as possible a kind of statewide picture of the water system, so to speak. What are the things, what are the drivers of use of the water, what are going to be the changing drivers of supply of water, especially with climate change. And, you know, when we're mentioning climate change, I assume that most of the committee has already heard quite a bit about this, but it's just important to stress here, you know, hopefully as a society we're going to become really effective at greatly reducing greenhouse gas emissions, so we reduce additional levels of climate change. But even if we tomorrow brought down the emissions down to zero, we know that because of some of inertia in the climate system, there's already some degree of change in the climate that's going to affect Minnesota that at this point we can't easily reverse. And how it's going to affect water is actually fairly complex. We focus here on the fact that there'll be increased periods of drought, but we also know that most of the climate models are predicting that there'll be just the really important thing is there'll be greater variability in precipitation. So we're going to get more extreme storm events. And unfortunately, especially with the amount of impervious land and surface that we have in the state right now, when you get those extreme storm events, not much of that water infiltrates well. It doesn't end up in our groundwater. Instead, it becomes runoff and often brings pollutants with it that actually exacerbate our water quality problems. And then we'll have these other periods of drought. So I think that the more we can get a really good handle on how does our whole water system function in the state now and what are the key drivers that are affecting that, it would put you in a better position than to anticipate how the system might respond under these different kinds of futures and then be able to, you know, think back to, okay, so what are the most important things to do, and water reuse, some system for water recycling or water reuse, you know, might emerge as one of the most important things to do. It seems to me that also getting really serious about maintaining water quality is going to be especially essential. To me, for me personally, that's one of the real realizations that come out of the modeling that Laura showed you, where you see that there's this trade-off or conflict between water that will be available for human uses and water that would have to be used for biomass crop production if we do invest in that in a major way. So that means that whatever little water we are trying to maintain for human needs, we really need to be sure that that water is clean and it's safe for us to use.
And if we can, Madam Chair, if we bring it back to your question about how you should think about what we presented today or the kind of work we've done. I guess a take-home message might be that we need to think of the future and think of the range of possibilities that are out there and think of not just best case or medium case, but worst case scenarios in the same way we think about insurance. We don't expect our house to burn down this year, but we still buy fire insurance so that if it does burn down, you can rebuild it. And so when we think of how we're managing water, whether it's for recycling or any other aspect of water use or other natural resource use, you should think about what are the possible futures, the possible scenarios for that resource and others, which of those are quite bad so that even if they're not very likely, they're so bad that we want to make changes now to ensure that we're not in a disastrous or catastrophic situation if they occur. And that's the kind of thinking that normally doesn't get incorporated into governmental or social or business thinking usually, because it can lessen your return on investment in the short term. And it's a trade-off we're used to making at home, but somehow we're not used to making as a society in the same way.
It's one of the things that strikes me as you're doing your presentation, we're only looking at 41 years in the future. It's not that long. Representative
Purcell
has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You were talking a little bit earlier there about the impacts of climate change and potentially where we've gone already, and that we might not be able to turn things around in the near term to our satisfaction, perhaps. And I noted that my question is that I noted in discussing the models, the only time I heard it was with that urbanized biotechia model, was the mention of catastrophic weather events. And was that, were catastrophic weather events that arguably we're seeing already, were those plugged into every model, or it's unclear to me exactly how these models are constructed, so I wanted to ask that.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, there were several scenarios in which people envisioned climate change impacting a variety of things in the ecosystem and in the social system. Because of time constraints and data constraints, the way I tried to represent one aspect of climate change was using the drought sensitivity, the one that I showed you with the three bars, in which one bar was water use in a drought scenario compared with amounts from precipitation that would be available for human use. So that was the one metric that I used to look at how climate change might impact those different scenarios. But you're absolutely correct that there would be a wide variety of other changes, and people did envision those other changes in terms of extreme weather events, increased temperatures, a number of things. So this is just one small snapshot, one small taste that we're kind of giving you. Obviously, the scenarios are extremely complex, and you could do a lot of different modeling with them.
The one follow-up question here, actually different, slightly different subject. It's curious to me. In bringing these human beings together that you were talking to, what was the conversation between, in these groups, between stewardship, we can try and do something to positively impact our future, and the kind of that pandemic, that failure, well, there isn't anything we can do about it, you know, things are going to happen, there's nothing we can, you know, people say that we're headed toward Armageddon anyway, that kind of a thing. Let's just, you know, get on that slide and here we go. I'm just curious as to how that worked back and forth in your group.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, yeah, that's a very insightful question. You know, I can't speak for every single conversation because they were going on in separate parallel groups, but then we did have the whole workshop would come together at 2 points. And I guess I'd say I was really impressed at how people did not get into did not spend too much time in a real deep funk about, oh, everything is going to hell in a handbasket. I mean, I think there was a certain degree of sort of really deep realization in your gut that things could get really bad. And there were moments when people got depressed by that. But fairly quickly, people turned to, well, so what would we do in this situation? And just starting to think about how to cope with it. And we would ask people at the end of the workshop, you know, to fill out these evaluation forms and then to go around the room and talk about one major insight that they had. And a lot of them talked about, you know, realizing how important it is to become much more agile at coping, because their initial reaction, their eventual reaction as a human being is to cope and to adapt. And I think we know from human history, humans are really adaptable. I mean, if we did end up with a pandemic waistline kind of situation across much of the planet, and I sure hope we don't, you know, I think the humans would still persist. We would still figure out a way to live. So I think that coping is fairly natural, but the key point goes back to one of the realizations that I made at the beginning of the talk. It sure would be nice if we can prepare now to cope and be agile rather than be victims of so many bad things that there's much less wiggle room in that coping.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, I see in your embedded in assumptions in your model that you assume that food and energy production per unit of land will stay at current levels. I'm wondering what your justification for that is. I'm a farmer, and when I look at the history of production in my part of the world, we've continually increased our production and our ability to produce efficiently, and I just don't understand how you can make that assumption.
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair, Representative, you're absolutely right. I should say that the model includes kind of the high end of the current ability to produce certain crops and on a certain amount of land and water. So it's biased towards the high end of what's currently possible. But you're right that we would expect to see changes over time. My point in modeling these scenarios was to remain as true as possible to the future that was envisioned by the participants in these workshops, to not try to add my own thoughts about what trends are happening. So in some of these scenarios, actually, there was an assumption of increased efficiency of production and increased production per unit land. The green industrial scenario, for example, envisioned very high production rates. So in those scenarios, I changed the production per unit land. But in a scenario like the regional self-reliance, under the assumption that we would no longer be able to get chemical fertilizers because regional trade has collapsed, you know, it's possible that production levels could stagnate. So you can take your own spin on it and kind of in your head shift the numbers one way or the other. The take-home message is not that these are the absolute be-all and end-all of what would happen in the future. It's more to increase the flexibility of thinking about the relationships between these variables. But I agree with you that, you know, there are many different ways these trends could play out in these scenarios.
One follow-up, Madam Chair and testifiers. We know that in Minnesota, development is gobbling up about a county worth of land every 10 years. Did you take that into your consideration, your scenarios at all?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. If you look at the graphs of land use in the future, in many of them, urban land, which means any developed land, has expanded, and that has eaten into land available for natural and agricultural uses. So, yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's also important to add that this model is definitely not a totally comprehensive, complete model of all the trends and all the relationships that we could have modeled about Minnesota. We just did not have the resources or the time in this grant to do that, and it wasn't actually really what we were trying to do with the models. What we were trying to do with the models was use it as a way to explore the scenarios from a different perspective than just people, the sort of inherent knowledge that the people who came to the table had. And so use it, try to illustrate, you know, with a few of the data trends that we could easily get a handle on, illustrate different ways that this could play out. So I don't think you should take home from this presentation that these five scenarios and this model is the be-all and end-all, more that this is a tool and this is a way of doing this kind of planning. If people wanted to develop a more comprehensive model, considering all these, you know, finding ways to actually
not have to make oversimplifying assumptions. That could be done. It would be a major undertaking, and it should really only be done if there's a big enough commitment on the part of important decision makers that they would actually use the output of that model. Otherwise, I don't think it's really valuable to just spend a lot of time making that kind of a model. Because the model is not an end in itself. It should really be a tool for, you know, a well-thought-through planning process.
Just one more point, Madam Chair. I just, you know, I've seen a number of different sorts of models, and every model I've ever seen, it does involve a number of assumptions, and those assumptions directly impact the output of the model.
That's exactly right.
I can reply, Madam Chair and Representative. That's absolutely true, and I think that's one of the take-home messages here, is that if one wanted to think about the kind of scenario that wasn't in the model, like increasing production in agriculture and forestry, then we have to ask, how is that accomplished? If it's accomplished as in the past by greater use of fertilizer and water, there are consequences for that, and then you could use that to look at what are the pros and cons of the increased production. Just like there's consequences of increased development and what that takes away from agriculture and forestry land. So each of these, the models aren't to be viewed from a positive or negative perspective. It's what if this changes, what other things change, and which of those changes are ones we think are okay, and which ones are ones we need to worry about.
You're done.
as I think about this, it still comes back to that if you're increasing your production at the same rate, you're probably going to be at more water use.
Well, we could be here all morning,
One comment on that, if you look at the recent advances in biotechnology, we do fully expect that the plants that we use on our land will use water more efficiently and produce more with less water. It's well documented.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a few questions, but I'll maybe start with a couple and see where it goes. One of my first questions is seeing that population increase in all the models except for the really negative bad one, the dystopia model. And was that a result of trying to be true to people's imaginations and people having a difficult time imagining us decreasing our population intentionally or as a result of different cultural shifts, or was it more a result of the modeling itself?
Madam Chair, Representative News. As I mentioned, I did try to stay as true as possible to the narrative that was presented in the scenarios. And in all of the scenarios except for the pandemic collapse one, people did envision a higher population in 2050 Minnesota. In some cases, much higher, in some cases, marginally higher. And people attributed that to both natural growth and also immigration. Interestingly, several of the scenarios envision Minnesota as a destination for people moving from other parts of the country or the world as those places get more difficult to live in due to, for example, climate change. So the population increase was trying to be true to the spirit of the scenarios as they were generated by people around the state.
And then three more. When you were looking at this, I mean, what kind of, did people talk about security systems being at risk? And when I say that, I mean it very broadly from, you know, thinking about New York City and they're pumping out water to maintain their city in Manhattan to things like having different diversity in our crop production and our food resources so we aren't wiped out with a single pest or a single widespread weather event. So what, did you have any insight into how we should be thinking about kind of our basic security issues with the models, or were people discussing that in the focus group?
Madam Chair, Representative News, yes, the things that you mentioned would be one example of responses to the questions that we asked at the end. So in this scenario, what are you doing to maintain water, and what do you wish people had done back in 2010 to ensure our ability to cope in this scenario? So all of the things that you mentioned, I believe, were brought up in various groups around the state. The need for diverse landscapes, the need for protection of critical groundwater resources. People really saw the need to preserve the key things that sustain our economies and our ecosystems.
Madam Chair, Representative Newfield, the only thing I would add is I think also a theme that seemed to emerge was people realizing that we need to maintain these different kinds of diversity, I mean, both in our water resources, our lands, the things we grow, and even in our ability to govern and who's involved in governing, to do that at regional and local levels, not only at the state level. Because even some of the less dystopic scenarios, we're envisioning a situation where it's become harder for centralized government, federal government for sure, and maybe to some extent even for state government to control or manage things, and therefore becomes more important for people at the local level to be able to do it. So I think, you know, I think one of the challenges is if you look at just something like water, we have you know, wide distribution of water availability in our state. The places along the northeast where we're sitting on the edge of one of the largest water bodies on the planet, Lake Superior, to the southwest, which is much drier and is potentially the most vulnerable actually under climate change models. So this issue of how do we improve that diversity and essentially flexibility at being able to adapt at a regional level, not only at the whole state level, was a very important thing that emerged.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That leads into my other question is, was there discussion about, we talked about preserving land, preserving water on the landscape, and conservation-based planning, but was there things about changes and what people need to know? I mean, in terms of fuel production or crop production or less importance on communication or high-tech and more importance on something like canning food. It's just kind of what we are teaching our young people and what's useful in some of these scenarios.
Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, yeah, it's very interesting that you mentioned that because that was certainly one of the themes that emerged around the state and was one of retaining key knowledge about how to operate, on a more local and regional level. And, I want to caution that this may be, the makeup of these groups was very particular, and, the insights that they generated were particular to the kind of groups that they were a part of. But in nearly every case of the workshops that I attended, people really stressed the need for generating local knowledge, local and regional knowledge and resources to be able to cope with a variety of different future scenarios. And there's a real emphasis on that. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Newt, the only other thing I would add is that we were conducting these Phase 1 and Phase 2 workshops sort of in parallel to the work that was going on to develop the LCCMR Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan. And interestingly, one thing that's in that plan, among the many recommendations, is a whole set of recommendations about improving the knowledge infrastructure and the databases, or better integrating databases that the state already has, making them more readily accessible. So I think that that's a real complement, actually, to the answer that Laura just gave you about the scenarios themselves. If Minnesota were to invest in some of this knowledge database improvement that is recommended in that plan, that would be very complementary to this kind of approach also to future planning. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My friend Representative Torkelson made me think of another question. I thank you. And regarding efficiency, we've gone from, I just want to know if this is too specific, you can just say, can't answer it, but if in your models there was consideration of efficiencies of our food production in the sense of calories produced per calories that we're using, and that's grown significantly over the last number of decades. I think we're about 10 to 1 now. We use 10 calories to produce calorie food, generally speaking. And is that in there anywhere? That's grown, I know, from 1 or 2 calories, you know, some decades ago to 10 to 1 now.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, the unfortunate thing about this, the brief time period we have for this presentation, is that I was not able to go into all of the research and the data mining that went into this modeling. And a colleague of mine, Chris Johnson, at the Sustainability Initiative, actually worked on a lot of the food part of the modeling. And he interviewed a lot of farmers. He looked at, you know, dozens and dozens of scientific reports on food production in Minnesota and around the country. And we used that information to fit into the scenarios that people were envisioning. So there were such a variety of them that we had to alter our assumptions kind of in the different scenarios we modeled. So, for example, in the regional self-reliance scenario, it was explicitly stated in that scenario that there is basically no fossil fuels coming into Minnesota. So we assumed that that meant no chemical fertilizers. So in that scenario, for example, we had to take kind of more numbers from organic farming, from farming that does not use chemical inputs, whereas in some of the other scenarios, they were envisioning farming much like we do today, and so we used numbers that were more consistent with what's currently going on in Minnesota. So we did do that. We did not generate an output of energy in to energy out for each scenario, but that could certainly be done if people are interested in it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schmidt, you mentioned that the makeup of the groups were very particular. Where did the folks come from, and how were they picked, and how many of them were there?
The people in the regional workshops were citizen leaders who lived in that region. So the citizens are the ones that are defined by the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, the Northwest Region, the Northeast, the Central Minnesota, West Central, and Southeast Minnesota. We also did one small workshop, Metro Workshop, but we actually did not come back to do a second one there because of time and budget constraints. But then we did the full Phase 1, Phase 2, and also the Southwest of Minnesota. And the way the people were picked, we, the researchers and university, did not decide that. The director of the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership, along with her team of directors, as directors for each of those regional partnerships, they have a board of directors. They went to their communities in the region and identified people to invite to come to the workshop. And Laura, maybe you can help me. I don't remember what the total number of people was for all 12 workshops. You know, we're looking at numbers, 150,
yeah,
maybe about 200 in total. And then at the statewide workshop, where we worked with LCCMR to identify who to invite, there were 44 people. And at that statewide workshop, of those 44 people, I don't remember exactly the ratios, but approximately a third were legislators from both houses. A third, or maybe more than a third, were, again, people from the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. They, again, decided who would come to represent their region, because we wanted people from all the regions. And then we had a few key people who had been involved, both who worked in the public sector and the private sectors involved in developing the statewide conservation preservation plan, and then a few researchers. So, again, I think it's important to, you know, recognize both the strengths and the limitations of that. Although we were fortunate to have this wonderful grant from the Bush Foundation, it wasn't a grant on a scale that would allow us to do this, trying to reach thousands upon thousands of citizens in Minnesota. That would be something nice to do in the future if people decide that's important. We would have liked to have involved many more business leaders, where the business people who came tended to be more people dealing with smaller, regionally based businesses. We didn't have a lot of involvement from, you know, our heads of our large corporations in the state of Minnesota, so that was one limitation. But I think the strength of it was that instead of we, the researchers, dictating who came to the table, it was actually the leaders involved in this pre-existing Regional Sustainable Development Partnership who picked those people, and we did get a tremendous diversity of people and perspectives, and people who are really on the ground in their communities and, you know, I think have a good sense of what's on people's minds and the pulse of the community. So, for example, even we had farmers, we had everything from, you know,
are kind of large-scale corn soybean farmers to smaller farmers. And so we had quite a bit of diversity of people, even though we didn't involve a huge total number of people.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. But, Doctor, from what I heard you say, actually, is a few people picked who came, and they were active in... What was the group, the sustainable partnership? I think you said the group came from, but they were picked, they were citizen leaders picked by a small group of people.
They were picked by the partnership. So the way the partnerships work, there is a statewide director who's Dr. Catherine Drager, and then in each region, they have a regional director and a board that helps to run the work of that partnership. And it was that board working with the statewide director who decided who they would invite from their community to come to the workshop.
I guess you're... Thank you, Madam Chair and Doctor. I think what you just said is... You said how the group was picked, how it was made up. It wasn't random. It didn't pick somebody that was just a landscaper active in their community or worked in the green industry or grew up as a kid in the Mississippi River. That my mom would let me do anything. She wouldn't let me go in the Mississippi River in Hastings. And it's different today. We mow board plowed everything in Dakota County when I was a kid. We don't do any of that anymore. The cattle walked in the Vermilion River in Vermilion Township. We don't let them do that anymore. I think there's some things here. I appreciate your insight and what you have to say, but I was hopeful that you would say this group came randomly from a broad spectrum of groups, and I'm not sure it was cherry-picked by a group of people for whatever reason, and that makes me nervous.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think, again, I understand your point. I think it's important to come away from this presentation, again, not thinking that these particular scenarios are the be-all and end-all. It's more that we're trying to show you a process that can be used to do more strategic and more agile planning. And, you know, we had both time and budget constraints, and we had a number of reasons why we decided to work with the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. One was that they already were well embedded in their communities and knew who would be some of the people who would actually take the time to come participate in these workshops away from things that are going on in their lives and would have an interest in contributing to the discussion. But you are, I think, raising an important point, and I think it would be very interesting, I mean, if people wanted to do more, it would be very interesting to go back and repeat this kind of process with a broader cross-section of people. Now, I have to tell you that I personally was, and I think all of us on the research team, were though surprised by the diversity of scenarios people came up with, even with the smaller sampling than a completely random cross-section of citizens in the state. We didn't show you all the scenarios that came out in each region. As I said, there were 10 to 12 of them. There was a lot of diversity, but interestingly, kind of the other side of the coin was, in spite of that diversity, there kept being these recurring themes, which are the ones that we built into the five scenarios that we kind of coalesced for the state. So there were recurring themes about people, as Laura said, expecting that fossil fuel use would be gone, expecting that we would be using more biomass crops, expecting that there would be some problems with water, expecting that there'd be in-migration. So I think a working hypothesis that I would posit is if we were to do this more broadly, I bet you that those themes would still come up. But I think the importance of your point is that there may be other very important issues and themes that didn't come up with this group that would be added to the mix.
I don't see any other questions. One of the observations is that you asked us each time, when you look back in time to 2010, what actions do you wish people had taken? We are the people in 2010 thinking about folks in 2050. And so this is to make sure that we have the imagination to make good decisions. So with that, thank you.
for helping us stretch our minds and think about 2050 and what we should be doing. I hope we're up to the task. We just have to be up to the task. Well, thank you for giving us the opportunity to present.
Yes, thank you.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned, and I'll bet they'll this book.
The Minuteman and Chair, February 17th.
So moved. Any objections? No objections to the minutes. The minutes are adapted. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.